Sounds good.
It's a delight to be here with Gray Hamilton, who, as I understand, is from the East Coast, a young husband and father, and recently moved to Waco, Texas. And Gray is starting a new YouTube channel, which hopefully will turn into a podcast as well. Interested in talking to people about ideas. And I wanted to get to know Gray a little bit and see what I might be able to do to help promote his new channel and answer any questions that he might have as well. So, Gray, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you grew up on the East Coast, what brought you to Waco, and
Sure. Yeah, thanks
maybe
for
even
having
what you
me.
think about the whole Texas life. When you said Waco, immediately I thought, oh, Chip and Joanna Gaines.
Okay, that's so, man, it's funny. You hear people, somebody start a sentence like that. When I hear Waco, I think, and it's usually one of two or three things. It's either Chip and Joanna or Baylor or David Koresh. Right, like those are the three things, and the
Oh,
Branch Davidians, that's kind
yeah,
of the thing.
that never crossed my mind when I was thinking about
Yeah,
it.
and it's funny, you can never predict when somebody starts that sentence which of the three is, when I talk to Christian Baxter, he's like, oh, I have family that went to Baylor, and he doesn't say anything about, he probably doesn't even know who Chip and Joanna Gaines are. So
Well, I
that's
spent a week in Waco in 1985, and it was one of the
wow.
most memorable weeks of my life. So
Wow.
yeah,
Okay.
we can talk about it later.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, thanks for having me. I've been a listen to your podcast for quite a while, and have just enjoyed it. You're a wonderful interviewer, so I just really appreciate you being on here, and I've learned so much from so much of what I listen to. But so I grew up in the East Coast. My parents are from Ohio originally, but lived in Manhattan for couple decades, I don't know, 15 years or so before I was born. My older brothers, I believe, both were born there. So very, I would say my family it exhibits a lot more characteristic in the Northeast than the South or the Mid-Atlantic, what however you characterize North Carolina, where I grew up. Which it's a very interesting place because it's a meeting, I think, of the two. I say Mid-Atlantic because it's not quite Northeast, it's not quite the South. So yeah, anyway, it's a very interesting place to grow up. You have a lot of very southern people. I grew up in a small town, and so you have very much the rural kind of population meets Northeast kind of transplant vibes. A lot of UNC and Duke grads, Wake Forest grads who were born and raised places like not Long Island or Connecticut, and came down for college and never left because it's a beautiful place. It's a really kind of interesting milieu to grow up in. And my family was secular. My parents, I think both at different times of their lives, this is a gap in my knowledge about them. Both at times in their lives had periods where they went to church and would have identified with the faith, the Christian faith. My mom certainly, like I was baptized as in the Episcopal Church down the road from our house outside of our neighborhood when I was a kid. But to my earliest memories, I can't remember actually attending that church, so we must have stopped pretty shortly afterwards. And was raised very secularly, very East Coast sort of neoliberal. My dad would have voted for George Bush in 2000 and Barack Obama in 2008. My mom would have voted for Al Gore and Barack Obama. So just kind of very that kind of generally East Coast sort of liberal politically type family. And when I was 11, my parents got divorced, and that was probably the biggest, if I kind of skip over a lot of my life, that was the biggest sort of family or communal event that happened was a rupturing of my family when I was 11. I have two older brothers. It affected all three of us tremendously. And just experienced a lot of strife in our family life, to do with that. And I grew up a very serious competitive tennis player. It's probably the other big kind of fact about my childhood. From a very young age, traveled progressively more from the age of 7 to the point where when I was 13 or 14, started traveling around the country, pretty much twice a month, 2 weekends out of the month or weeks out of the month, all the way through 18. but I stayed in public school. So I went to a very large, like 4,000 person kind of public school. So I sort of straddled the life of an elite athlete, traveling a lot, but also really always wanted to have both sides of it. And so my mom felt it was very important for me to have like a normal, a quote unquote normal life as a kid, with going to normal school and friends and all of that, despite being a top tennis player in the country. And so I ended up going to the University of Mississippi to play college tennis after very my recruiting. It's one of those things you look back on and you can see those moments where your life might have gone a drastically different direction. I desperately wanted to play for the University of North Carolina, and I went on my visit and I, long story short, partied too hard, said some dumb things, got myself painted up the wrong picture of who I genuinely was, enough to not get the opportunity to play there, which was heartbreaking. So that would have sent my life in a very classic, in the same direction as many of my friends. I probably would have stayed in North Carolina, stayed on the East Coast at least, gone into banking or law or finance. The other, when that didn't work out, I committed to play at Columbia in New York, which would have sent me on the Ivy League route. And again, probably would have stayed in New York, I think, for the rest of my life. I mean, would have been on a finance or law route, probably would have gone, politically in a certain further in a certain direction. That didn't work out because of finances. It was going to be too expensive. So I ended up at Ole Miss, which is about as far from Columbia as you possibly could get in almost every manner of describing it. And played college tennis there for 4 years and had a great experience and went from going in a very East Coast, like I said, secular liberal kid to coming out and kind of right after graduation, becoming a Christian, largely due to the influence of a couple friends that I got to know in college and a former mentor who came back into my life and a lot of things. And so at the age of 20, I guess I was about 22, I was playing professional tennis and I, yeah, just experienced crazy life change, became a Christian. There's a lot to that story, but ended up stopping my professional career, tennis career at the time, right as COVID started. Things were getting a little fishy, with traveling internationally to play tennis tournaments. And so I went into coaching, and that's what brought me to Texas. So I came and was in Dallas for 3 years coaching at Southern Methodist University, and then I met my wife, Gretchen, in Dallas through friends at our church, which was the first church I ever, like, was not the first church I ever attended, but the first church that I moved somewhere and chose a church and became part of that body. And we dated for 10 months, engaged for six, got married less than a year and a half after meeting each other, which was really special. And we lived one more year in Dallas and then moved down here to Waco. Gretchen was a Baylor grad, and so it was coming back for her, and it was coming for me for the first time to work at Baylor, where I coached for the last 2 years, until May, actually, when I lost my job because the department wanted to effectively push more money towards football and basketball, is the easiest and shortest way of saying it. And so this summer was a huge sort of desert for our family, trying to figure out where we are going to go, what we are going to do. And I've since landed in a really a great temporary or medium term situation here, teaching at a country club. And so we're staying in Waco. We had bought a house. So for right now, we are here, and we're stable. Praise God for that. But very much in this season of our lives. I'm 28, she's 27. We're just turned 28, and I turned 29 in a couple weeks. And we are, I think the original, how our conversation sort of came up, was you had commented on a conversation that I had with Jordan Hall. It was the first video, I believe I posted on my YouTube a month or 6 weeks ago, where Jordan and I were talking about, he had posted a tweet about viewing this civilizational moment through the frame of wartime or wartime re readiness sort of perspective, and specifically for younger generations or younger folks getting their family life started, or maybe they haven't don't have a family yet or whatever it might be, people my age. So I reached out to him and had that conversation, and you commented and just said that you enjoyed the conversation and would be happy to share some of your story about your early life, early married life, and things like that. And it definitely struck a chord with me. And so I guess that kind of brings us up to the present day. We one other fact is we had a daughter 6 months ago, our first child, and she's amazing and has been incredibly beautiful for 6 months of her life, despite the sort of turmoil that we've experienced, sort of professionally and financially and otherwise. So that kind of brings us to where we are now.
Wow. So, so you had a conversation with Jordan Hall, and then you had a second conversation with Jordan Hall and Annie Crawford.
Yes.
Could you comment on what you learned, both idea-wise and in your own, kind of life response? To both of those conversations. Like in the first conversation with Jordan, do you recollect what that felt like talking to him and what you might have learned through that whole conversation? And then what caused you to want to reach out to Jordan and Annie to put them together? Because that's a really interesting combination.
Yeah. So I guess if I could go back, like the last couple years, a couple threads or sort of collections of ideas that have really been circling in my head, and something that, when I've listened to so many different people in the space, the things that really like stick out to me the most, and largely probably because they're relevant to my life, but because I think they're also the most maybe solution oriented or mapping a way forward more than some of the ideas that are often discussed here, which not that that's makes them better, but just is maybe more the way I think or the way I'm hoping things I can get out of listening would be ideas around community life and how we grow, specifically maybe as Christians, how we are sanctified through relationship with others, rather than a frame that is, I think, often used about in a certain way of my relationship with Scripture, my relationship with God through very individualistic ways of thinking. And the other sort of set of ideas is the sort of topic of ecumenicism and how to think about the different branches of the church. Because I came to faith, I guess it's been about 5 years, 5 and a half years, and it was in a Protestant context, very Protestant context, evangelical, non-denominational. And that was the embodied context I was in and the people who influenced me. But the ideas I was most influenced by, the speakers, the thinkers, the writers, like I mentioned, I think before we started recording, Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Pageau, John Verbaeke, Paul Vanderclay, everyone in this little corner, and then, older writers like, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and going back to reading Athanasius, the Church Fathers. I followed those rabbit holes, starting with Jordan, going to Jonathan, which is very, I think, normal for probably a lot of your listeners, and then just realizing the incredible, awe-inspiring breadth of the Christian tradition. And I felt this for multiple years, like 3, 4 years, really up until probably this last year, this just difficult friction of, okay, I came to this authentic faith in the triune God through these people and these places and this context that is decidedly Protestant, non-denominational, not very intellectual. But I saw Christ through people who could not, who would never read a C.S. Lewis book. And I heard Christ and I experienced his love through these contexts, through Protestant churches. Like I gave my life to Christ in a Protestant church, not a denominational. And then on the other side, causing that friction is just this incredible, like just being drinking so deeply from these wells of ancient Christianity all the way up through someone like Jonathan and his commitment to the Orthodox faith and learning more about the Orthodox faith and the Catholic faith and everything in between. And really it was hard because I was living, I got to Dallas and I joined a large, a mega church, Protestant, non-denominational mega church that leans pretty Baptist as a lot of non-denominational churches do. And I was again experiencing just authentic friendship and what Christ-centered community looked like. And I was taken in by people in Dallas and I was invited, I met one of my best friends who ended up being in Gretchen and I's wedding because he just invited me to coffee and then said, "Hey, what if we had coffee at 6 a.m. every Wednesday?" And I said, "Okay, I can do 5:30. I can't do 6. I have to be at work by 7, but I will commit to 5:30 a.m." And he lived 20 minutes away from me. And so for a year and a half, we had coffee every morning, every Wednesday morning at 5:30. I would get up at 4:45 and he would always have an Americano ready for me in his apartment while his wife was sleeping. And we would just talk for 2 hours, talk the Bible, talk faith, life. And I think if I were to tell him you should read something prior to John Calvin, he'd be like, why? besides scripture. And so this friction was so real. And this is the point in the conversation where, so I marry my wife and she is very much, gosh, such a wonderful, wonderful woman who's so meek, humble, relationally focused, very in the moment, just loves to serve others. And she's so joyful. And gosh, I could talk so much about her and how much she's impacted me. And she, this is not a friction that's live for her. And so that's part of it where I'm like, man, I don't want to like this journey, even if I start to agree intellectually, maybe with more from the Eastern tradition or from the Catholic Church, like I don't, this is not a direction I want to go where I'm potentially causing my wife and my family like this really, and maybe some of that is cowardice, but I just felt like I don't want to introduce this really difficult, rupture for her or for us, when I do genuinely see so much of the truth in the Protestant context of where we're coming from. And so a year and a half ago-ish, and I'd heard Jordan Hall speak before many times, but obviously all these videos start to come out about his conversion, if you want to use that word, to the Christian faith. And I'm starting to listen, I'm listening more and more, and he starts to articulate some of these ideas about and tell the story of the Protestant church that he came to faith in and the community. And he starts to use the word communion, capital C communion, for what he witnessed and wanted to be a part of and stepped into in that church. And it just like he was giving language to something that I had felt. Like the really the heart of why I didn't feel sorry, there's a truck driving by. Like the heart of why, even apart from my wife, the heart of why I individually felt an uneasiness about just stepping out of my context, stepping out of the places I was to enter into maybe the Orthodox or the Catholic tradition. He was putting words to that, and he was unashamedly, as a new believer, sometimes it was just able to say, like, I'm experiencing the love of God in communion with these people, and that is real. And he wasn't, and on the other hand, saying, I've read 10,000, I'm reading 10,000 pages of theology, I'm reading all the church fathers, I'm reading all these things, and I have respect for the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church. Most of the theologians he start was quoting and talking about are Eastern fathers, and so I'm like, okay. This is somebody that I really want to pay attention to, because he's giving me language to help understand the thoughts I've been having and giving flesh to those. And so really fast forward to this summer, I, for the past few years, my job has been so, I effectively work 7 days, was working 7 days a week, at least 8 months out of the year. And when I wasn't working 7 days a week, I was trying to spend as much time with my family as possible, obviously, and traveling to see our families that are in Minnesota and North Carolina, and still basically just as busy, but not working. So I lose my job in May, and this summer, for the first time, I'm essentially taking care of my daughter, until my wife went back to work. It was both of us, but then once she went back to work, I became really her chief caregiver. But I would have more empty time during the day when she was napping than I'd had in years. And so I drop into one of Paul Vanderclay's live streams for the first time, not because I hadn't desired to do it before, but because I'd really never had the opportunity. And so I dropped in and was part of an estuary conversation so 2 days after Jordan had tweeted this little mini essay about this sort of wartime framing, understanding our civilizational moment through this sort of lens of fifth gen spiritual warfare. And I proposed it as a topic, and we talk about it, but didn't really get into the meat of it. And so I reached out to Jordan, and I know that's a really long preamble, but it just gives like it's important context for like I really Jordan has been very specifically helpful for me. And so I reach out to him, and I said, can we talk about this more? Because I'm even this morning, I'm reading Colossians, I'm reading Ephesians, and I'm seeing like your tweet is right there with what St. Paul's saying, and I really want to dig into that. So he's incredibly gracious, said yes, and we talk, and that conversation was, the thing I think that is maybe most helpful about Jordan is he is incredibly articulate in like the most precise manner. That doesn't mean that I'm saying he's right about everything or that he, but he's very, very articulate in saying nearly to as exactly what he means as almost anybody that I've ever heard. And so he helped me see, like, spiritual warfare has always been a difficult thing to understand, and Jonathan Pageau helped me understand it more, far more than I used to. But that conversation with Jordan, where he kind of says, like, here's the history of war, and here's Paul talking about spiritual warfare, and here's what fifth generation warfare, if you want to use that term, looks like today. And these two ideas of spiritual warfare and fifth generation warfare, and how that relates to our personal faith and our community, the way we live our lives in community. Like he brought those ideas sort of into a stack for me that really felt like they lined some things up that I'd heard, I'd been thinking about. But it was like, oh, bringing those together and help me understand those things as a stack. And so at the end of that conversation, one other thing I'd wanted to ask him, because I knew he had young kids, a 7-year-old and I think just a young son. And I'd wanted to ask him about education, because I think that's something that in this corner of the internet, like it's referenced, it's occasionally talked about very sort of abstractly or for 5 or 10 minutes, but it seems like, and I can say this, it's very salient for me because I have a young daughter that I'm going to have to figure out how to educate. But I'm like, guys, this is one of the most important things we could possibly be talking about. Yes, our individual journeys, and this little corner has helped so many people. Jordan, Jonathan, John have helped so many people, like find meaning, go back to church, like grow themselves so that they're capable of pursuing someone else in marriage and being a useful part of a community. But then, okay, so what happens when we have to guide other people, children, through that process? And can we avoid the crisis of meaning that so many of us experienced as a result of largely as a result of the way that we were raised? And so at the very end of my conversation, I asked him about that, and he just had a beautiful sort of, we only had 20 minutes left, so it's just a little bit of a teaser as to his vision or articulation of what education can and should be, and should aim at. And so a couple weeks later, we're at Midwestuary, which was an amazing event, and Annie was there, and we talked for a minute, and I saw her talking to Jordan across the room, and then later she came up and she said, "Hey, I was just talking to Jordan about education, referencing the end of your video and what he had talked about, and we should talk about this because I think there's a lot more
Mm.
there. And I was like, I couldn't agree more. And I think you're the perfect person, Annie, being someone who's in the trenches of actually having just homeschooled her kids. She is a trained classical educator in a co-op context, in a very sort of liberal, busy techie city in Austin. And she's actually doing it while also being extremely educated in what education should, can, and should look like. And they come at things that, like, it was just a beautiful the way it came together, because I think Annie and Jordan, I think even yesterday in our conversation or 2 days ago, they found that they ended up articulating things in very similar manners, but they come from two totally different perspectives. And so it was really cool how that came together. And the last thing I would say is, and I briefly mentioned it at the beginning of that conversation in sort of an introduction, was we scheduled that conversation for last week, on the day, literally to the almost the minute that the Charlie Kirk assassination happened. And we got 10 minutes into the conversation, and Jordan happened to have a scheduling snafu, where we had to stop and reschedule, and none of us knew about what had just happened. And then, of course, over that afternoon, everything unfolded, and we all kind of independently had this feeling of like, oh, that was it's providential that we did not finish our conversation, and that we needed to reschedule, and now have an opportunity to not talk about the event, but to talk about the topic of education after this momentous event in the life of our country, but also for anyone thinking about formation, education, if you pay attention at all to the details surrounding Charlie Kirk's death and his assassin, and how he was radicalized via the internet, and if thinking about the way he was educated in a broad sense, it provided a sense of urgency that catalyzed what ended up being a great conversation a couple of days ago. And so it was, I learned a lot. I think we're probably gonna need to have a follow-up, because we didn't get into the, Annie was like, we should talk again and get into a little more of the practical of what is the content of this education look like. But it was really helpful to have them essentially, I won't curse, but Jordan carpet bombed the F out of public education, was his quote. And for Annie to articulate, like, this is what she's doing in her context, but also the challenges of partnering with the church and community to truly educate our children, and getting into also the issues we see in the church that specifically preclude that from happening in a lot of circumstances. So
Yeah. Oh, wow. There's just so much there.
yeah, sorry,
That
that's a lot.
that's okay. I mean, you really you encapsulated it extremely well. I appreciate it very much. And I will make a few comments. I really like where you started with the whole thing about community life and are we sanctified through our relationships with others, what is the connection there? And I had very similar, well, I can't speak to what your experience was, but my experience of becoming a believer was in a very small country church in Iowa. I was already almost 32, and I won't go into all the things that led me to faith, but a lot of it had to do with my concerns over what was happening in the world at that time, which happened to be the late 1970s when our economy was falling apart and the US had become very weak, and there were a lot of global players that were intent on destroying our country. And I sort of woke up around the age of 30 and said, hey, wait a minute, what's happening? And maybe I should be involved somehow. So I started researching some of this stuff and fell into a lot of rabbit holes, which some of which at the time everybody would have said those are conspiracy theories. And so after I came to Christ, I put all that stuff away and just threw out all my documentation and everything. I had a whole room full of documentation. I was pretty far down the rabbit hole. That was before the internet. So if you wanted to keep something, you couldn't keep it in a file on your computer.
Yeah.
You had to keep it in a file on your bookshelf. And because I didn't want to be a conspiracy theorist or any of that, and when Christ came into my life, I had no more fear. I wasn't afraid of any of that anymore. So I just got rid of it all. And then I have had the privilege or the tragedy of over the last 45 years watching it all happen, just unfurled exactly the way that I had read about it. So that gives me a perspective on things that fits in with all of the other things that you were talking about. So shortly after becoming a Christian, so in this little country church, and as you said, it's a little, it was a, it had its roots in the Evangelical Friends community, the Quakers
Okay,
that
yeah.
would sit around in silence and wait for the Holy Spirit.
Sure.
But a few years before I joined that church, a young pastor had come in. He and his wife had been missionaries with the Navajo Indians for 25 years.
Wow.
And then he came and was pastoring this church. So he had a very unique perspective
Sure.
and really instilled in all of us a deep and grounded faith. And the people in that church, many of them had been together as a body for decades and truly loved one another and loved Christ. And so I had the privilege of watching this community of people all caring for each other in this area. And so, but anyway, shortly after becoming a Christian, I was tapped by a former employer. Maybe I might want to run for the legislature. And so I ran and I was elected. And one of the committees that I was on was the education committee. So I got a really close look at the inside of what was going on. Plus, a lot of parents who were concerned about education were coming to me with documentation of what was going on. And the strange thing was, you might think, well, farming community in Iowa, how bad can it be? But the reality was that. And again, this sounds like a conspiracy theory. It really does. That the people who wanted to corrupt the educational system decided to target places like Iowa because if they could get it to fly in Iowa, they could get it to fly anywhere. So a lot of the stuff
Really
that came
interesting.
in later in New York and California and other places was already well established in Iowa in the late 1970s. So one of the things that I confronted as a legislator right away that I tried to make a difference in was a bill that had been passed in 1978, which established a certification requirement for all teachers to have an annual class in which they'd have to be certified in multicultural non-sexist education, which sounds very benign. But it was anything but benign. It was kind of like the DEI camel's nose under the and of course, the other thing that had infiltrated education at that time was values clarification and situational ethics. And I don't know how much you know about either one of those things, but
Well, from the just from the names, I know a little bit, but no, not in detail.
Situational ethics on the surface sounds kind of cool, you know, like everything is love. And of course, anything can mean anything depending on the context that it's in. And so, you know,
Yeah.
it's basically
Postmodern
it was the
ethics.
forefront of the postmodern everything is relative idea, but couched in this very high-flown philosophy called situational ethics. And so they put a lot of nice terminology around it. Values clarification was the idea that, and this was flat, I mean, it was laid flat out in the kids' textbooks. Your parents' values are not your values, and you can come up with your own values, and it's important that you do. And we're here to help you clarify your values. And they had several ways to help you clarify your values. One way was that they used to have what they called circles in elementary school, where the kids would sit around in a circle with the teacher. And if they were really little, the teacher would give them those stuffed animals or dolls to play with. And then they were encouraged to use this doll to represent what's going on in your household right now, and what kinds of things are your parents saying, and what are they expecting of you? And the argument that they make is maybe these kids are being abused in their home, and therefore we want to know about that. But the way that they can use that, it's almost like the Hitler youth or the communist youth,
Oh
right?
yeah.
The kids are tattling on mom and dad, and being encouraged that these things that your mom and dad are saying, they're not good for you. It's better for you to choose your own values. And then the other way that they would come in with this values clarification is that they would posit these. There's a word for it. I can't think of it anymore, but a kind of a situation that you're supposed to think about, and then what would your answer be? One of them was, you are in a lifeboat with, or you're on a ship that's going down, and there's only one lifeboat, and there's only room for 15 people. And here are the 20 people that are on the ship. Which ones should not get in the lifeboat? And so the name, the kinds of people that would be on the ship would be, here's a 32-year-old doctor, and here's an 81-year-old pastor, and here's a young mom with a child, and here's today maybe it would be here's a guy wearing a suit who's a MAGA Republican, something like that. And who are you going to leave out? And who goes in? And so kids in junior high are sitting around thinking which lives are valuable and which lives are not worth saving.
Man.
So about the same time I had gotten involved with pro-life, obviously becoming a new believer, and I'm going to all these pro-life conferences. And at one of the pro-life conferences, there was a priest talking, and he was quoting from a book that I subsequently went out and bought, which is no longer in print. You can't buy it anywhere. Little tiny book called The Release of the Destruction of Life Devoid of Value. And man, that sounded just like the values clarification exercises to me. So I went out and I got that book. And that book was basically just a publication of an essay that had been written in the early, maybe early 1920s in Germany. And, or maybe it was the late 1920s or early 30s. I can't exactly remember, but it was a couple of guys who were bioethicists. And they were talking about which life is devoid of value. So they were trying to establish a chain of reasoning. So you start with someone is in a coma. Well, okay, so what if they're, what if they don't have signs of life anymore? Maybe they're still functional, but maybe there's just no the brain waves aren't right or something, and so you think they're never going to wake up again. Is it okay to pull the plug? Well, yes, of course it is. Well, who makes the decision? Would it be family members? Would it just, what if no family members available? Maybe it's just the doctor then that's able to make the decision. The person themselves doesn't, can't make a decision because they're in a coma. So is that really very much different than someone who's mentally handicapped? Because they can't really make a decision for themselves. And so then maybe their family members should be able to make a decision for them, depending on how mentally handicapped they are, and how mentally handicapped you have to be before this kicks into place and you can make a decision for them to end their lives. And then from there, you move on to not just mentally handicapped, but what if they're of some racial category that is not, you know? And so they move through this whole chain of reasoning in this little essay till they get to the point where you can basically do away with anybody, old people, mentally handicapped people, and here's how to do it. It's a terrifying, and you can understand though how people would read that and be captivated by it because it's all written in this language, you know. Well, about the same time then in the German textbooks, you find that they're having math problems that are saying things like, well, if it costs I don't know, 20,000 German marks to take care of one mentally handicapped person, and it takes 20,000 German marks to take care of a family of four with a father and mother and two children. And when there's, you know, or let's say it takes, you know, then how much does it cost to take care of each person? They're just little math problems, but they're word problems that are worded in such a way that you start to think, oh, well, there are considerations here that have to do with, you know, whether a person's life is worthy of value or not. And
You sound a lot like an effective altruist. I don't know how much you know about that movement,
yes,
but
I
that,
do. And that's exactly why I like so that all of these things that I learned back in 1980 are things that
that's
when I see
crazy.
this stuff happening now, I go, oh, that's this other thing that happened back then, right? And so all of those things really gave me a radar for what's been happening now. And then the other, so I got in a lot of trouble in the legislature,
I'm sure.
lot of trouble. It's
It's
kind of,
crazy that this was all happening in Iowa. I mean, it's just
yeah.
that's a really, I mean, I just never would have guessed. Never would have guessed that that was happening in Iowa in the 70s. It makes a lot of sense when you describe it that way. If you are willing to believe or take the leap, that it was these things were intentional,
It
which
wasn't just Iowa,
people
it was
really want to
Iowa and
resist back then.
Arizona. A lot of the good stuff that I was getting was from parents in Arizona that were concerned about the educational system, that were writing
And that
newsletters
surprises me a little bit too. I mean,
detailing all this stuff. Yeah.
yeah, but people really want to resist making that leap of the intentionality really hard, you know? Even in this corner, I think it's a little bit incendiary. Like, I think Jordan, and I'll let you continue, but Jordan bringing this whole wartime frame in, it makes people really, really squirrely about, oh, well, who is the enemy? And, let's bring the idea of principalities, distributed intelligence in to help understand who the enemy might be.
Well,
And
back
it's a
then,
lot of it's trying to avoid.
I'll tell you what the enemy was back then, and that was federal money. Because that had just, I can't remember, I think the Federal Department of Education came in 1978, maybe. Because I remember one of the first things everybody wanted Reagan to do when he got elected was to get rid of the Department of Education, because it would have been so simple back then because it was much smaller. But one of the first things that the Federal Department of Education did in Iowa, that was, they used Iowa as a test case, was to divide Iowa's 100 counties, not across county lines where individual school boards could have a say, but across 15 area education agency lines. So they set up 15 districts in Iowa. Each one was an area education agency funded by federal money and given a certain purview of what they were supposed to do with that money. And then the state universities would come up with research that would get this federal money to implement this research. So one of the things that we ran across was a program developed by the university, Iowa State University, in their home economics department that was called parenting education, but it really didn't have anything to do with parenting, and it didn't have anything to do with education. And it was a whole notebook full of classroom exercises that the teachers were supposed to do. And in order to introduce this curriculum to the teachers, who would then introduce it to the schools, the area education agencies set up workshops and conferences to teach the teachers how to teach. And one of the parents had infiltrated one of these conferences and then had come and told me and the legislator who was from her district. She was telling us about this. And so we decided to bring it to the attention of the legislature because the lessons themselves were appalling, but the way that they were training them about the lessons was even more appalling because they would have the teachers sit in a darkened room and they would flash expletives on the screen in fluorescent colors. Every gutter word that you could think of, all the playground words, and flash it on the screen. And then they would tell the teachers, if you feel uncomfortable with this language, then you need to go home and lock yourself in your closet and say them over and over again out loud so that you don't have any sensitivities at all to using this kind of language.
Wow.
Because here's the lesson. You're gonna set up your classroom, your ninth graders, and you're gonna divide the boys and girls into pairs. One boy and one girl make up all these pairs in the classroom. And then they're gonna talk to each other and talk about all the sexual terminology that they hear on the playground about any sort of sexual behavior. And then they're going to write down these, I don't know what you want to call them. The kids would probably call them dirty words. I don't know, whatever you call it. They put those on a piece of paper, put them in a basket, and then the teacher takes the basket up front and she unfolds one of these and she says it. And then she says, here's the biological activity that's actually happening here. And here's the scientific
Ooh.
terminology for this. And
So let me take away any sense of taboo, essentially. Like, let me just couch
yes, and
this in
let me
super
take away any
scientific.
sense of mystery and beauty and glory and,
Wow.
and that
Well,
was.
you're just blackpilling. You are just really, yeah. That's,
This was just one simple example. There were
yeah.
many worse, many worse. I felt like I had to wash my brain and forget it if I could, because I was a young mom at the time. I mean, I had a daughter who was in sixth grade, something like that, maybe sixth grade, fifth or sixth grade. And the thought that this kind of material was going to be used in her classroom was really terrifying to me. So anyway, we brought this to the attention of the legislature, and a couple of very funny things happened. One of them was that we printed up some of the pages from the book, the lesson plans that had been developed by the university, because we thought maybe we can stop the funding that the university, they were partly funded by federal money and partly funded by state money. So we thought we can't block the federal money, maybe we could block the state money. So we put these in brown envelopes and sealed them and gave them to the House pages to distribute to the other 100 legislators. And they all started opening up their envelopes, and one of them pops up with his mic and he says, how dare you distribute filth like this in the hands of these high school pages? And we said, well, that's our concern. This is going to be used as educational material in the schools. And then he says, how dare you accuse teachers of not knowing what they're doing? Because they're educators. So in their hands, it's a completely different thing than you just sending it around in these envelopes. So then we tried to explain, well, one of the other ways that they're educating these teachers is showing them a speeded up movie of a man and woman going to a motel room, taking off all their clothes and having sex on the bed, on the floor. In every position. And because they want to desensitize the teachers. So then there's this big uproar on the floor, and they said, we have to have a committee meeting about this. So we got the film, we had the committee meeting behind closed doors. Then the newspaper goes after me and my colleague saying, they called me an archaic anachronism of an ancient age and a bimbo and everything else because I'm worried about dirty movies. And then they accused the legislators of being behind closed doors with dirty movies. So then we said, well, let's have a public hearing about this stuff. So we had a public hearing and we called parents to come in and testify on our behalf. But the PTA sent in experts to testify on behalf of the teaching material, saying that we were, today they would call us ignorant MAGA hats, what they would call us, you know. So anyway, I'm sorry I'm going on and on, but that was the kind of thing that happened. And I became kind of famous and ultimately was run out of town on a rail, so to speak. My party turned against me and ran someone against me in the primary that they knew could take me out in the primary, but they also knew couldn't win the general election. So they ended up losing my seat to the opposing party, but it didn't matter because they got rid of me. So,
Thanks for telling that story. I mean, that is, don't apologize for going like that detail. My gosh, if anyone watches my conversation with Annie and Jordan, and I'm just thinking of one person who commented this morning, I think, and at one point in the conversation, Jordan had said something like, and obviously this is almost maybe he even wants it to be incendiary, but he really means it. Like, public schools effectively have written on there. So again, of course, the FedEx truck wants to drive by. Oh, he's turning. Public schools basically have written on the walls, you know, you should hate God and hate your neighbor. You know, he says something effectively to that effect. And somebody commented and said, "Oh, Jordan, you're being ridiculous. I, you know, if becoming a Christian made you know, this closed-minded, like public schools don't want your kids to hate God. You know, elementary school teachers don't want your kids to hate God, and they're not going to make your grandkids hate you," just re reacting to what he said. And I'm like, I would point them to the stories you just told.
well, but I mean, here's the problem. And the reason that your commenter actually makes a lot of sense is that not every teacher is that way. And
No,
not
and
every
Jordan
teacher is.
wasn't saying the teachers, right? Like, that's
Sure.
what, like, the detail of your story is, like, it's not even the teachers. Like, you never once said that teachers were the problem in any of these scenarios. You know, it was
Yeah.
actually things that were being done to the teacher. I feel bad for the teachers whose livelihood depended on this and are controlled by teachers' unions and the government and money, mammon, you know,
Yeah,
influencing
well,
all that.
and you just brought up teachers' unions, and that's the other problem. A lot of the teachers didn't want to participate in the kinds of things that were being pushed by the teachers' unions, but you don't have much choice. And one of the reasons that teachers back then didn't have much choice was that you really need somebody to stand up for you, if things are. People can be unjustly accused in the educational system. And so the teachers' union provides attorneys and negotiators to work on behalf of the teachers if they're unjustly accused. And all of that's a very good thing. And you can also get through your dues payment to the teachers' union, you can get malpractice insurance because things can happen in a classroom. Even if you don't do anything wrong, something can happen in a classroom, you can be blamed for it. Maybe a student is climbing on a desk without you even wanting them to, and they fall and hurt themselves, and then you're subject to malpractice. So teachers need malpractice insurance. It's incredibly expensive to buy on your own, so they buy it as a group in a teachers union. The problem is that the teachers union, at least the National Education Association, uses that money for political purposes, for political
Oh,
organizing.
sure. I mean, just look at
And
what they're
all
doing
of their
now.
political organizing is only in one direction. And every single, like we used to get the annual, my husband was a teacher, so we would get the annual brochure of all the political positions they were supporting, and there were like 457 one year. Every one of those 457 political positions were 180 degrees opposed to everything we believed in. But we were having to pay, and at the time, I think it was $400 or $500 a year, union dues, and that was a lot of money back in 1980. That was almost like a whole month's salary for my husband,
Sure.
and we're having to pay that as union dues. So one of the things we decided to do was when I got in the legislature and had a little bit more visibility and street cred, was to help with starting an organization that would oppose this. And there were some people who had already started working on this to start a professional educators association for teachers that would do everything that the NEA does except for the political organizing. And the dues, we got it down to where the dues were only like $150 a year or something like that. But that included your malpractice insurance. It included negotiating assistance if you get in trouble with the school and all that. And the other day I got to thinking about it and I thought, I wonder if they're still going. And I looked it up and they are.
Wow, that's
And
great.
it's a pretty large organization in Iowa. And I would hope that every state would do something like that. Because teachers shouldn't have to be stuck with only one option.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So anyway, that was where I was with education.
No, that's fascinating.
The other thing I want to talk about is you said about the tension that you feel because of all the different denominations and what passes for anti-intellectualism in some of the evangelical circles. And I've felt that tension myself the last few years, but I have many decades of experience in the Protestant tradition, in the evangelical tradition, and I've never run into any, and I'm not saying anything about the people that are talking about church hurt. I deeply feel the hurt that they have experienced.
Sure.
And I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody. But I've been in many different churches in my life. I've never been in a church that has ever treated anybody that way or that would have ever intended any kind of that kind of pain to people. I mean, I just haven't run into it. But I'm sure it's out there. And I've talked to a lot of people who've been there. But also that doesn't mean it's pervasive. I think it means that some people have ex had bad experiences and they're the ones that kind of come to the foreground and are the most visible and vocal. But that's also happened in the other religious traditions, right? Because we are all sinners. And so I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm going to say things that are very controversial here, I'm sure.
Please, please do.
So I love all the people that I've talked to from the Catholic tradition. I've had some great conversations and really wonderful, deep people and learned so much from the intellectual depth and reach of Catholic people. I bought Bishop Barron's Word on Fire New Testament and I love
Beautiful books.
it.
I have them too. They're beautiful.
Beautiful. And for a long time I was even using the Word on Fire daily liturgy. It's
Me
wonderful,
too.
wonderful way to share with our brothers and sisters in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church uses this language of everybody should just give up and come home, all come into the Catholic Church because that's where everybody belongs. And then our Orthodox brothers and sisters also, it's very exclusive. Come into the Orthodox Church because that's where the truth is. And they also have a beautiful tradition and they love the Lord. I've seen so much beauty in the Protestant church as well, and depth and people's changed lives and people who never would have come to Christ, but they came because of the move of the Holy Spirit in their lives. And I can't look at that and say, well, that's not real just because it didn't happen within this other tradition.
Bingo.
So I was thinking about it and I thought, when Paul talks about the body of Christ, we tend to think of it, he's talking about all these different individuals, and we all make up the body of Christ. And each of us, as followers of Christ, we all make up the body. But couldn't it equally be true that all these different denominations are parts of the body? And shall the eye say to the toe, well, you're not as important as I am, or you're not as legitimate as I am? And each part functions so beautifully because every cell in that part is also functioning to keep that part of the body. Let's say you're talking about the heart or the lungs or the brain or something. All the cells that are in the lungs are working to keep that lung functional and functioning at the highest possible efficiency and excellency. And then all of the organs of the body are functioning to keep the head, And then the head is also functioning to maintain all the parts of the body in a healthy way. So the whole thing is working together. So maybe all the people who are in the Anglican Church are part of some organ in the body, and all the people in the Catholic Church are part of another organ, and all the people in the Orthodox Church are part of another organ, and maybe all these little Protestant traditions are different parts of the body, and all the people in each one of those traditions is keeping that part together, and then all the parts together, and then Christ is working with all of us. And I mean, to me, that's a picture that I can handle of an
It's
ecumenism that points to the head as being the one who gets all the glory. And that's where we should be focused, is not on whether our tradition is the right one, but on who is the one that we are glorifying.
That's good. So there's a lot there. So in the very beginning, it's interesting. You said, like the Catholics say, everybody come on home. So you say that word home, it reminded me yesterday, the day before on Twitter, someone. So I have it pulled up. It's really simple. He said, "There's a strand of quote, just take the best from every tradition end quote that I think prevents real communion. We should talk about a balancing with the spirit of quote, focus on the fullness of one tradition." Now he's not, and he posts it with a screenshot of Joe Rogan, Tim. I can't remember, popular podcaster, New Age spirituality kind of 4-hour work week. What's his name? Do you remember that book, The
Tim
4-Hour Work?
Ferriss, Tim
Tim
Ferriss.
Ferriss. Yeah, I've listened to him so much. I can't. It's funny I don't remember his name. So it's Joe Rogan, Tim Ferriss, and the Modern Wisdom guy. So he's not talking about the fullness of one tradition within Christianity. He is. These guys are guys who are curious on all traditions, Christianity being one tradition, and. Somebody else replied, John Zepp replied with a good thought. He said, "I feel like identity is both emergent and received. Do you think this quote, no past from nowhere, end quote, is a rejection of the received, which requires a doubling down on the emergent? If so, this might explain a lot." And this is where it comes home to you. I said, "I think in more cases, it's probably an inadequate connection of love to the received, most often caused by some abdication of responsibility and or love somewhere upstream, likely first occurring many generations upstream." So received relates to that word home. So think of Catholic people saying, "Everybody come on home." Home is not just a location, like we all know that. Right, like home is to relate it to what you're saying in the Christian sense. Home would be where Christ is present, right? Like it's not and the woman at the well, right? Like home is not the temple, home is not the mountain. Home is where I experience and am in communion with Christ and with his body, with his children. And that could be anywhere, right? In spirit and in truth. So truth is a big part of it. Spirit's a big part of it. So when you say that, I'm like, yes, the denominations can take the part of a different parts of the body. But I think there is, like, you know, Annie said this in our conversation yesterday, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because we're all three of us are Protestants. Don't throw the Catholic baby out with the bathwater, because there's a lot of truth in not just propositional truth, but also truth of form in the hierarchical structure of Catholicism and Orthodoxy that is very true to reality, like Jordan talks about. Because we were outlining this parish model as being the most real, like the form of church and community and education that is the most true to reality, is this parish model of people that live in close proximity to one another, in deep relationship with one another, that go to church with one another, are part of Eucharistic communities, right? Pursuing Christ with one another, and go to school together and work together and teach each other's kids and all of this, right? And that there's a number beyond which and a distance beyond which that is not possible. And the Catholic, and Jordan said, you know, you explain this to most many Protestants, and they would say, that sounds really Catholic. It's like, oh, it is in a certain sense. But not Catholic in the word, in the way that maybe you're describing it with this like negative connotation. But it is Catholic in the sense that they understand that is a feature of Catholicism and Orthodoxy, that hierarchical structure that exists because of the consistency of that tradition across time that Protestantism in varying degrees has, but mostly has broken down for, you know, the Anglican Church has fallen apart and split, just so many splits. And so to go back to Catholics calling everyone home, it's like that for many people, that is so their sense of being home in the Catholic tradition is so far removed in time, generations and generations back for most Protestants, American Protestants especially, that to relate Catholicism to home is just like a laughable. It may be true proposition. Like I may even say, like I agree, if I were to fall one on one side or the other propositionally, like I may agree with you there. But in the sense of that spirit or that communion in spirit and in truth, I'm not sure that you can just say, oh, convert to Catholicism and you'll be home. Because I know, like, you hear stories, you hear of people converting and then you know, going back to Protestantism or going to Orthodoxy or going around in a circle, thinking that their problem will be solved by going to the tradition that has the highest claim on truth, the most propositional truth, and then they don't experience capital C communion, you know, like Jordan describes. And that would be quite jarring, I think, if you think that you're coming home, to then, you know, walk in and it doesn't feel like home. And so the other part of what you said, you then have to face the reality, or simultaneously, you have to face the reality that the Spirit of Christ is obviously, inarguably present in the lives of people across every single tradition. Like you just, it's futile to try and argue against that. Like I, and it's both sides that make this error, or all sides. You get Protestants, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, I'm thinking of the church we went to in Dallas. And if you're close enough, like I had friends that were on staff, a lot of, if you're close, you know, almost in Lewis's inner circle, you know, sort of idea, you hear stuff that's going on behind the scenes, and you hear about, you know, a buddy of mine that was on staff told me a story of someone who, it was a married couple, and the husband was starting to become curious about, he was reading more, and he's becoming curious about Catholicism, or so I think it was Catholicism. And, you know, he was brought in by church staff to have a very serious conversation about, like, you're falling away kind of thing. And so when I say anti-intellectualism, these are not people that are not intelligent or well-read. These are not like bumpkins. These are people that went to like the best Baptist seminaries and would consider themselves to respect the intellectual tradition of Christianity, but only from one stream. And so that when they are confronted with someone from their church who might be curious and seeing some incongruencies with the totality of the picture of Christianity that they've been taught, and is thus widening their view, that is seen as a threat and as a falling away, rather than something to be engaged with. And even if you disagree with where Catholicism may land, like engaged with in a fruitful manner. And that stem, I really think if you take a wide enough look, and this is why everybody in every tradition should read incredibly widely, is because if you, I read Dallas Willard is one of my biggest influences. If you think, if you're a Catholic or Orthodox, and you think that there is no intellectualism in Protestantism, or let's specifically get into the Baptist tradition, which takes a lot of flack. And I would not consider myself like a Baptist in propositional terms, although I do go to a Baptist church, so that's kind of funny. But if you think that there is no intellectual history or tradition, high level philosophy, theology in the Baptist tradition, you have no idea what you're talking about. Respectfully, because Dallas Willard, you read that his biography and how he was raised in hyper rural Missouri with no electricity in his house until he was like 15, and going to the most rural of country Baptist churches, and just grew up with this beautiful, beautifully blossoming relationship with God in the nature of rural Missouri and in that country church, and the relationships that he had with the men and women that took care of him when he had family struggles and he was moving around and all these difficult things, and the people that were part of his life, and then becomes this just incredible philosopher, translating Husserl from German to English and becoming the head of philosophy at the University of Southern California, and writing books that have influenced millions of Christians to better understand and embody their relationship with Christ. I mean, his book, Renovation of the Heart, is just, when I read that book and I read his chapter, I think the chapter about sort of the beginning talks about sanctification and what the life with Christ can look like. And he describes the concept of death to self. That, like, one of the most, I can remember the exact table I was sitting at the exact coffee shop in Dallas, because I put that book down and I was like, I never understood what death to self meant until I read what Dallas Willard just wrote. And I am confronted existentially with what Christ calls us to. And that's from a country bumpkin born in rural Missouri, who was born and raised and remained Baptist, as far as I understand it, although he definitely had a lot that he differed on theologically, philosophically from many Baptists, remained Baptist, and in all of his books quoted and praised the reformers among the church fathers, right, in a properly ecumenical manner, his whole life. You cannot read that. You cannot study the life of someone like Dallas Willard, among many others, and honestly come away believing that the light of Christ is only to be found in Catholicism or Orthodoxy. I don't think it's possible. And if you do, then I would wager to say you're intellectually dishonest. And
Well, I
yeah.
guess that's one of the things that bother is too strong a word, but it's one of the things that I find perplexing. If I were going to make the if I were going to make the claim that the Catholic Church has the whole truth, they're the only ones that have the truth. And yet, the Catholic Church makes the claim that the truth can only be found in us, or that the true communion with Christ can only be found in us, based on my experience of life, of all the people that I have met, that, our little Dallas Willards all over the place, including this pastor and his wife that spent 25 years with the Navajo Indians and understood at a depth that I could never attain the kinds of questions that people have about what it means to believe Christ rather than to believe whatever your tradition is that you're coming out of, right? The very fact that some people, and maybe not everybody says that. I don't know if that's a motto of the Catholic Church or not, that we're the only place where you can, that this is it, we're the only one. Anytime I run across a Protestant church that says that, and there are some, we're the only ones, you know, like I remember
Oh,
back
there are a lot. Like I, that's my example of doubt. Like it's you could say the same example about
in.
Thomas Merton. You know, people love to hate on Thomas Merton because he flirted with the Buddhists, and I think a lot of people have problems with Thomas Merton. But are you really going to read Thomas Merton and tell me that Thomas Merton didn't know Christ? You know.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a whole Protestant tradition called the Church of the, there are many different Church of Christ traditions, but there was a Church of Christ tradition in Boston where they said, if you're not baptized into our church, you're not a believer. You know, so I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that. When I run into any tradition that says that, if you're not with us, you're not really a believer. That to me is a huge red flag.
I mean, it's the biggest red flag. If you need
Yeah.
one red flag, that might be the one.
Yeah. But to go back to what you, when you first started on that, you were quoting that tweet about the fullness of one tradition and that the idea about what is received as versus what is emergent. I read that tweet thread too. I thought it was a very interesting tweet thread. When I think about what's intended with the fullness of one tradition, my idea of ecumenism that would really be an ecumenism is not that the traditions start compromising so that they can all join hands, because that would be the emptiest of all possibilities, but that each tradition would become the fullness of Christ as much as they can within their tradition, so that Christ is glorified in that body, whatever that body is. Let them pull together and glorify Christ together as a body in their lives and in their families and in their communities and in their church. Let all of that happen. And there, that is ecumenism. We get whatever the traditions are. Because years ago, back in 1986, I heard a message that never left me. And I think it's from Ezekiel 47 or 48. Talking about when the water begins to flow out from the altar and move out past the altar. And at first it's ankle deep, and then it's knee deep, and then it's thigh deep, and then and as the pastor is talking, he says, and then it covers the fences. And once it gets up above the fence posts, he says, the ducks are floating everywhere. I thought, oh yes, that is the picture, man, you know.
Yes.
Once the water gets deep enough, there are no fences anymore. So let's get the water as deep as it can be everywhere. That's ecumenism in my mind.
Yeah. That's so good. That is what it is, Ezekiel, I believe. That is one of the most beautiful passages in scripture and ways of understanding the Holy Spirit too, as water. Beautiful. You'll have to look this up, or maybe I'll send it to you after we're done, but there's a one of my favorite pastors to listen to. His name is Tyler Staton. He's only a few years older than me. He's at
Yeah, he's at Bridgetown
He's John Mark
in
Comer's.
Portland.
He came after John Mark, and he's just beautifully eloquent, poetic preacher in the proper sense. And he wrote a sermon series. He turned into a book on the Holy Spirit, and talks about the different images in Scripture used for the Holy Spirit, and that he has just an absolutely beautiful sermon on the Spirit as water, and he uses that image from Ezekiel. And yeah, it's wonderful. I'll send it to you. It's that, and that's where, yeah, it's always like a wrestling back and forth. It's interesting that we ended up talking about this, because a big topic, I think, in the corner right now too, is this, like, weird, and after what happened with Charlie Kirk, and at Midwestuary, Rod Dreher and Elizabeth Oldfield had a conversation about immigration. And there's this conversation, I think, that people are realizing that needs to happen and continue, not like one conversation, like there's a conclusion to get to, but just an ongoing opponent processing of, like, where should lines be drawn? What should those lines look like? This is within the church, this is outside. Like, it's almost like a meta conversation of how do we understand through the lens of the Bible, through the lens of Christ, the inner and the outer. Like, I appreciate Jonathan Pageau's characterization of orthodoxy as he views it to be the fullest expression of the faith, but does not deny that the Spirit of God is moving, what he would say, out towards the periphery in this. Did I disappear for a second there? That the Spirit of God is moving out towards the periphery in this proliferation of different Protestant denominations. But also, I think, like, a Catholic might say, and might answer you and I and say, like, oh, the proper vision of Catholicism is this beautiful variety, but under the umbrella of the papacy and of the church. And you, I think you do. I'm not an expert on Catholicism by any means, but I think you do see that this beautiful variety of, like, a there's South American and Middle American Catholicism that looks different in many respects than a European high Catholic Roman Catholicism and places all around the world. But you read a book like Silence by Shinzaku Endo, and you read at least the copy that I have, the story ends obviously in a place that just leaves you like in a puddle. And then you the my copy has a has an interview with him. Maybe it was right after he released the book, maybe it was like 20 years later, of him just providing some reflections on Christianity in Japan and the Japanese people and Christianity and just the difficulty that he saw with those two, with Catholicism trying to find a place in Japan, and how so many died. And then that, and again, I don't know the history, someone's going to correct me, but like there was this huge push, and that's what the book is trying to represent. And then afterwards, it was like this question of why, like, what for? Like, it got back to a place where Christians were almost completely anathema in that country, and it appeared that there was little to no fruit from the efforts and from the lives that were spent in that evangelistic effort. And that's not me saying that any of that was, like, please don't hear me say that the Catholic Church should not be trying to make inroads in any and every corner of the earth, but it is like a picture, or like a slight view of, or argument for what you and I are talking about here, of like the light of Christ is going to be refracted in even the most unique of particularities culturally. And I think can be without sacrificing truth. But that's not a, clearly, if you look at all the many denominations, like the one you mentioned, of like you're only saved if you're baptized in this church, clearly that process is not an instant process. Like, all of a sudden, Christ doesn't just light up one Japanese person and then this beautiful, perfect, particularized but also Catholic in the lower C Catholic sense, and Orthodox in the lowercase O Orthodox sense, version of the church appears within Japan. No, it's like it's a messy human endeavor as much as it is a divine endeavor. And so the church, in one way splintering but also sort of diversifying, you almost might say, and again, this could get me in trouble, and I could very well be wrong, necessarily is going to be the wheat and the tares together, but also may lead to more unique human persons being reached by and changed by whatever degree of gospel truth, the Spirit of Christ that exists in those particularities in their context, even if there's plenty of tares mixed in with the wheat. If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I'm still back on Shusaku Endo. Silence. No, I mean, I did hear everything that you said, but I read that book when I was a missionary in Japan.
Oh, I didn't know you were a missionary in
was a
Japan.
missionary in
I
Japan
should have
from,
stopped talking 5 minutes ago.
no, well, not that I know any more than anybody else, but I was a missionary there for 3 years from 86 to 89. And I read that book while I was there, and it had a deep impact on me. And I have a lot of reflections about the church in Japan. We're not going to have time to go into all of that.
No, I don't have too much longer.
But that is such a grim and horrifying book, and the implications of it are just so hard. But I also think that believers today are not being trained up. We're not being trained up for what's coming.
Yeah, you mentioned that
When
in the tweet
I
that
was a new
sparked this, yeah.
Christian, I was told, read Fox's Book of Martyrs. And there was also a new Book of Martyrs that came out in 1980, maybe 80, maybe 1980, 1982, something like that, that detailed the stories of a lot of the martyrs that were missionaries in China during the Boxer Rebellion, or the missionaries in Africa, when the different tribes were fighting each other, and then began killing all the missionaries. And the stories of these people and the dedication that they had in spite of what was coming against them, I think we all need to be reading those books. We all need to understand what it means to stand for truth and to be willing to give our lives for Christ, because ultimately that's what we're called to. Whether that giving our lives for Christ is right now doing this thing that's right in front of me to help somebody so that I give up my time and energy for this thing, or whether it is the ultimate calling to give up my life for Christ, to be willing to say, in the face of a gun in my face, are you going to relent from your faith in Christ or not? And that could happen to anybody and is still happening to people all over the world.
Certainly.
Not
And
all
I,
being written up
yeah.
in books, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, to go back to like my conversation with Jordan, that was one point we kind of touched on was like this. And we obviously have just spent some time talking about a vision of ecumenicism and what that might mean. But in a sense, the moment that we're in calls for a seriousness. That I love what you just said, and I will think about that a lot. It may very well be that after reading the Gospels, the next thing you should read as a Christian in catechesis is stories of the martyrs, in any time or place.
Well, of course, it's
But
going to get you in a lot of trouble reading Fox's Book of Martyrs if you're a Catholic. But
yeah.
and so I'm not trying to point up any division between,
No.
I'm not trying to point that up. What I'm trying to say is that in the situation of silence, the people relented, not always just for themselves, but to prevent the torture of others. And in the book that I read that talked about a lot of these missionaries that were killed by rebels and by anti-Christian forces when they were there, they would be told, if you don't relent, we're going to rape your 4-year-old daughter right in front of you. What are you going to do?
Course.
But many of them still proclaim Christ and refuse to relent, and the whole family was killed and thrown into a pit. I don't know the answer to any of these things. I just know we're not being trained up to even think about it
Yeah. And the
because
moment
life
is
is too
yeah.
easy here.
And the moment is that, gosh, that is exact point. That is exact point Jordan made at the very beginning of our conversation was we have lived in the easiest. We are perhaps the generate my generation specifically, but really anybody over the last 100 years have been perhaps raised in the easiest, or certainly raised in the easiest, most comfortable time in the history of humanity. And we've lost sight of the fact that it is very much not the norm and very much not guaranteed to continue, despite what the techno-futurists and effective altruists and et cetera, might lead you to believe. This is very fragile And we're seeing that, with what happened to Charlie Kirk is just an example. I know. I mean, there was a school shooting the same day. There's many examples on the left and the right and the this country, that country. But to Jordan's point and to your point, it's like Christians need to be trained up to understand that the call of their life is to die to Christ, and what that could actually mean, and increasingly more so may mean, even in this context where all we've understood is relative peace and comfort. And so you're better off. Gosh, like you put it in this frame, it's like if someone in my context, like I have a, it's easy when you're around a bunch of young parents to like complain or moan about not sleeping, or oh, I when I'm not working, I got to be doing this or that, changing a diaper, all this stuff. It's like if you can't die to yourself in order to sacrifice your momentary desires for the good and care of your own child, without complaining, what would lead you to believe that you are capable of dying to yourself to proclaim Christ and to live as a Christian outside of your home and in the rest of your life, And so, man, if you need to start somewhere, start with, I try to, what if I'm annoyed my daughter's crying, I try to start by dying to myself to realize I have absolutely no business being annoyed by that.
That's the great part about getting married and having children. When you get married, you discover you're really at heart a very selfish person. And then
Oh,
when you
yeah.
have children, you discover you had no idea how selfish you were.
Oh my gosh. It's just insane. And I used to think I was thinking this when I was on a walk with my daughter this morning. I used to think, like I'm a, especially after I became a Christian, I was single. I'm like, man, I like am pretty joyful most of the time. Like I have a pretty good, even in certain circumstances, I'm doing pretty good at this like overall positive, joyful outlook thing. And then you get married and you might be having a great day or whatever, but your wife or your husband is, for whatever reason, they're having a really hard day. And guess what? Like you are now one flesh, and their hard day should is and should be also yours to carry that burden. And so now you got to figure out how to enter into their spirit and be in that space with them and also help take them out of it and vice versa. But then you have kids and it's even an, I mean, it's a baby, like you said, it's another level of that same phenomenon. But it's such a gift too, because if you lean into it, like I've already felt this in the past few months. I mean, my daughter's in her 4 month sleep regression. I mean, the sleep is just not happening. And I've just become keenly aware of like I can choose to be at, at 8 a.m. when I've only slept for 3 hours or whatever, and I need to go walk a few miles with her in the carrier because she only wants to sleep in a contact nap. Like I can choose to be thinking about how I'm so tired and gosh, I hope she falls asleep and stops crying, or I can like this is couched within the unbelievably unearned gift of getting to steward another human life that is half me and half the person I love most in the world. And I don't care if she cries for the next 24 hours and I sleep none of it. It's still just a gift completely. So.
I don't know if you've tried this, but sometimes taking him for a drive is like magical.
Yeah, she, if you time it right, if you time it right, she'll sleep like an absolute baby after a few minutes of whining in the car. But then you stop the car and you can be in trouble. And so I have driven across Waco up and down Highway 6 for like 2 hours straight multiple times. So I mean, gosh, we pull out all the stops. We've gotten pretty good at the napping. It's the nighttime. It's
We
resistant.
used to call it date night. We'd put her in the car and then we would just drive around for a few hours.
Oh man, it's great. Like I said, you embrace it and it's beautiful. I mean, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever been a part of. So, man.
So my daughter is just 3 years older than you, so
Oh, okay, very cool.
yeah.
Very cool. Man, well, Karen,
I have two daughters. One daughter is 24 years older than that. So yeah, there's 24 years between them.
I gotta get going here.
Yep. Well, this
But
has
I mean,
been absolutely great.
yeah, thank you so much.
We went places I didn't expect we would,
Yeah, me
but it's
too.
been super interesting.
Me too. I, you know, sometime we'll have to talk again. I'll have to have you on my channel. I'd love to ask about your experiences with community and things like that, because that's another, I think that's another avenue that we could have and should go down sometime. I'd love to hear your kind of thoughts on that, because that's if there's one thing that continues to swirl in my head and is very much a part of my wife and I, you know, medium term, we're thinking, constantly thinking these days about should we not pull the plug, that's the wrong metaphor, but make what would be a difficult move to go back to where her family is in Minnesota. She's in multiple generations back in Minnesota. Her great grandmother, who's 103 and still doing wonderfully well, can cook and read and all the things, lives in Iowa, in Des Moines. And so her family is Iowa, Minnesota folk, and we having a child makes that the absence of family so much more, just you're keenly aware of it at all times. And so we're thinking about should we make what would be a difficult and uncomfortable move for us in many ways to sort of try to stitch ourselves back into what's been a multi-generational life for her family in Minnesota slash kind of that Iowa area. And weighing that with like the community that we have here in our church and leaning as fully into that as we possibly can and put trying to put down roots and stuff. So I know that just kind of teases things, but that's very much sort of my context right now. And that's if I was to think like what is the sort of telos of what I'm trying to do with whatever conversations I host or have, like talking to Jordan and Annie and all these things. Yes, it's like maybe I'm talking about the specifics of education because I'm thinking about educating my daughter, but so much of it, like this community piece and roots and our formation, like I mentioned in the beginning, in relationship with others and through that our relationship with Christ, like that is the thing. It's not a thing, but that is the telos of what I'm trying to chase after in this space, in these conversations, and in my life with my discernment of the voice of Christ in all the ways that he would choose to communicate with me, so that I might lead my family, you know, through this time in that way. So thank you for we'll talk again for sure, but thank you for, you know, having me on and talking. This was a ton of fun. I learned a lot.
Thank you so much, Gray, and have a wonderful week and give my wife your best and give the baby a hug for me.
Yes, I will. Absolutely. All right,
Okay.
Karen. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
See ya.